This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark and Roshan Kanisan. It is 6am, Friday the 20th of November. So not only is it the last working day of the week, but it's also Universal Children's Day today. So in conjunction with that, we're going to be having an interesting conversation later on The Breakfast Grill. I'll be speaking with Daryl Fong, Executive Director of Aquawalk Group, which of course manages the 60,000 square foot Aquaria KLCC. So that's going to be a very interesting conversation, particularly since, you know, themed attractions like Aquaria, they're not doing so well in these recent times.
Yeah, Lynn, and beyond that, actually, we're speaking with UNICEF in about an hour or so, at about 7:15, for World Children's Day special as well, to take a look at how they've been impacted by the pandemic. And beyond that, if you're a little itchy for some content around Universal Children's Day and how you can educate your kids, well, yesterday on Ring In Sense, I took a look at the personal finance side of things, and the podcast is called 4 Ways to Teach Kids About Money. Yes, a bit of a clickbait title there, but there's way more than the 4 tips there. I did this with Raymond Gabriel of People Systems Consultancy, and it was quite a interesting conversation, I have to say. He himself is teaching his kids money through, they're basically using their own hands and getting them involved with money. Very, very interesting. I definitely encourage everyone, not just parents, but everyone, to take a listen. And I'm not being biased.
Not just because it's your pet topic and the show that you helm, right? So yes, no, do take a look at that conversation. You can find that on the BFM app as well as on Spotify. In the meantime, though, in this next hour or so, we do have other fascinating conversations lined up for you. Later on after 6:30, what are we looking at, Roshan?
At 6:30, we always take a look at the international world, taking that flight around the world. But today, we're not going too far. We're sticking around in Asia, taking a look at Singapore and how it's dealing with the pandemic, and also with President Xi Jinping and his APEC speech. And yes, I did mess his name up there. Hopefully, I don't get reprimanded for that.
It's all right. I think we're a little bit beyond the reach of the Chinese government here. But, you know, so that's what's going to happen later on at about 6:30. And of course, 6:45, we look at our own local papers and portals as well. In about 10 minutes, what else are we talking about?
Well, in about 10 minutes, we're going to be talking about leadership. It's something that we talk about a lot this year because of a change of leadership earlier this year. And basically, the question here is, are we or have we overemphasized the need for great leaders? And I think this really comes off the back of the Trump presidency, right? Have we put too much faith in having one leader spearhead everything?
So that's going to be an interesting conversation. You can WhatsApp us if you want to weigh in on it, 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, though, we are asking a question that may sound familiar to Roshan Kanisan. We're asking you, how do you teach kids about money? So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Rocket Man by Sir Elton John, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Roshan. Now, the first story that we're looking at this morning in light of Universal Children's Day is a story about a Singaporean father who taught his daughter a rather roundabout lesson in responsibility and I guess how to be careful with your money going forward. This is a story from Mothership. And basically what happened was that this man's 13-year-old daughter borrowed his Nintendo Switch to play with and gave it back to him with a cracked screen. The daughter found out that rather than scolding her and getting her to apologize, he just asked her to take responsibility for it. And she found out that it would cost 150 Sing dollars to repair the Nintendo Switch. But he realized that it was only the screen protector that was damaged. So in reality, it would have cost about $3, not 150. And one thing led to another. But it's an interesting experiment in how to engage with children about value and about money, and how to be careful in how you decide to spend that money, right?
Yes, basically, long story short, when it came down to it, the father's lesson here was that not that the child hadn't done her research into the cost of repairing the screen, but she hadn't inspected the damage herself, right? Which is a very, 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 very important lesson when it comes to any sort of again, accountability issue. You have to inspect the damage for yourself, right? And what it was the screen protector had only broken, not the screen itself, which is why then he...
The vast difference in cost.
And eventually it's a very eye-opening lesson. And sometimes it's lessons like this that can really teach us the value of money and just the way it makes us critically think, right? So like I mentioned a little earlier, yesterday I had a conversation with Raymond Gabriel about how to teach kids about money. He's an author of the book, The Money Quotient. And he's essentially written a sort of syllabus for financial literacy for kids and even older adults. And some of the things that I think I personally agree with is one, giving your kids pocket money from an early age, right? And then kind of encouraging and then letting them choose what to do with that money. And this is what was applied to me, I guess, as well. When I was very, very young, I must have been 8 or 9 years old when I started getting those one ringgit coins. That was what I used to get for pocket money on the way to school. And I kind of understood that I could use that money to buy other things as well. So I would just leave it at home and not take it to school. I was beginning to understand and grasp the concept of opportunity cost at a very, very early age and delayed gratification. I would not have gotten that if, let's say, I was just allowed to, if I was just given things as opposed to, because I know some parents and some of my friends who were like, no, I don't want my kid to become materialistic. I will just provide them whatever they need. The term need, I guess, depends, right? But I don't want them to think about money. This can be short-sighted because later on, your kid can come out having a very, very little grasp on the concept of money, which can be very dangerous.
Yeah, it can. And I think ultimately, when I come back to this article and I look through it, the first time I looked through it, it has screenshots of the text conversations between the father and the daughter. And I thought the daughter was older because of how these conversations were carried out, right? You know, it has snapshots of, you know, oh, my proposal is this. And then the daughter says, okay, I accept your proposal. And then there's this banter and this haggling almost that goes on because she's like, okay, this is too expensive, but how much can I give you instead? She says, no, that's too cheap. And then it goes back and forth. And what this says to me is that they have really normalized these conversations around money. And this is part of, this is no surprise to her that the father would have taken this tack. And she's only 13. So this is, I think, a very interesting example as well of how, you know, as a parent, you can encourage your children to take the initiative to think about their own mistakes. Because when she found out that it actually only cost $3 to repair, she was like, hey, that's not fair. You know, that's mean. That was my birthday money. And the father said, okay, I'll give you back the money if you tell me what you did wrong. And then she responds with this wall of text, you know, proper analysis and everything, saying that, yeah, you know, I should have gone from multiple sources. I should have collected the information and then made my own estimate of what would have been a fair amount. I didn't read this properly. I jumped to conclusions. And then he adds on with, okay, from my perspective, this is also what went wrong here. And then, okay, agreed. All right, then I give you back your money. You know, so it is a very interesting way of going about it, I think. And I think it would be, this is something that you have to start relatively young, though, I think, because this is a habit that you build up over time with your children, these conversations. Because I do know people like, you know, like those friends of yours whom you described, Roshan, who are very leery about talking about money, even with their partners, much less with their children.
Yeah, all of this is not great, right? Communicating around money and about money is important to break the taboo that is about money, right? A lot of times we don't talk about these things because for lack of a better word, it's taboo. Now, including kids in the discussion, even if it's just in the background, even if they're just sitting around listening to you, can be very, can expose them to the different concepts, can expose them to the economy, can expose them to what is debt, what is the bills, what is money, you have to pay for this. These are all very essential concepts for them to learn and grasp, and including them and creating awareness around that is so, so important. And one other thing that I think I picked up in this conversation with Raymond, and I've also observed in my own life, is that getting kids to earn their pocket money is also very powerful, right? Whether it's chores, or when I was a kid, I used to wash the cars in the house. And I used to actually write out little bills. I'm like, okay, this is your receipt for whatever. But, you know,
Did you get them signed in triplicate?
No, I did not get them signed in triplicate. But, you know, these little things, giving massages to aunts who came over, just to kind of, because I understood the power of revenue generation. But on the flip side, jumping back to the materialistic side of things, it's important to also then, what Raymond does with his kids is he takes them to orphanages, takes them to places to see how the less fortunate live. And it gives you a sense of value and a sense mm-hmm. of appreciation and humility for the way you live and the life that you lead. And what the kids do is they donate half their money that they earn. I mean, they don't need it, but it's just learning about money and learning about the appreciation for that.
So if you want to listen to that conversation in full, you can find it. It was yesterday's Ringgit and Cents, so you can find it on the BFM app as well as on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. But in the meantime, let us know how you teach kids about money. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we're looking at the need for great leaders, whether we've overemphasized it. Be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Get Over It by the Eagles, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Roshan. Now, I'm looking at an article in Fast Company today, and this is, it's interestingly titled. It's titled, It's Time to Talk About How Joe Biden Defeated a Dominant Model of Leadership. So this article is talking about the perception that we need these kind of great, big personalities and great leaders in order for a country to truly be successful. Now, Joe Biden is not your conventional example of what people would call a great leader, right? If anything, particularly to his supporters, Donald Trump would have been that great leader. He was that bold personality, makes big promises. But Joe Biden ran on a platform of stewardship and of strengthening the institutions of the country. And that ultimately came out on top, although, of course, the election is still being kind of disputed at this point in time. So that raises the question of whether or not people going forward will continue to choose these kinds of slightly more sedate, I guess you could say, these kind of quieter, more inward-looking, but nevertheless staunch personalities to lead countries or even just companies.
Yeah. So this, in a short, is called leaderism, apparently. It's the belief that great leaders are the cure for every ill. It feeds on our desire for clarity and comfort, for a world of heroes and villains in which someone strong will save us. In another way, I guess we can call this the superhero complex, right? Mm-hmm. That Superman will come and save us, that Wonder Woman will come save the day, that someone other than ourselves is responsible for saving the day should something go wrong. And this has been the general leadership, concept of leadership throughout the last, few decades. Obama was that, Trump was that. I'm pretty sure, I'm not sure whether Bush was that, but Clinton had that air as well, not to mention JFK. But that's just our country, right? Even during the Tun Mahathir era, when he was prime minister the first time, it was only Mahathir could fix it. Mm-hmm. When Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim says, I've got a formidable majority, my party can fix it. Again, it's coming back to the cult of leader, only I can fix it. We need to move beyond that because it's too much concentration risk in too few people, in my view, right? And if we go back to the original meaning of prime minister, for example, prime minister is the first among equals in a cabinet. He's not the leader. He's the first among equals. He's the coordinator of a cabinet of equals that each have their own portfolios to manage, not a patriarchal leader that steps down and say, no, you do this, you do this. It's a coordinator. Mm. And I really do feel we need to go back to that because we're becoming overly reliant on the concept of having great leaders steward the way towards the future. And I'm not saying that having great leaders is a bad thing because they can oftentimes accelerate it, right? They can accelerate the way we move forward because of their vision and their drive and their energy. Think Steve Jobs in his second coming or Mark Zuckerberg in the early days. But look at Mark Zuckerberg today. He's showing the example of what an autocratic leader looks like. Yes, he broke stuff and made great things, but now his company is looking awfully a lot like an autocratic society, especially since in their dual class system, he can't be changed.
Yeah, he doesn't have any check and balances, right? And that is the system that when it comes to government, we want to avoid at all costs because we want the people to have a say.
Or even for corporations, I would say that.
Absolutely.
I don't like the fact that dual class shares inherently tip the balance towards founders. I do believe founders need some kind of security, but to Mark Zuckerberg has 90% of the voting shares, and so does Evan Spiegel for Snapchat, for that matter. I think Evan Spiegel and the co-founder have 98% of the voting shares. Highly imbalanced.
Ultimately, I guess it is that shift of perception to say that, you know, in at least in the case of Joe Biden, 4 years of good enough is good enough, right?
Yes.
You don't need to have that fiery, passionate, you know, loud, bold personality to keep you moving forward. Sometimes you need the people in the managerial roles, right, to step up and to just continue guiding the ship slowly forward. That's not necessarily a bad thing as long as you are still moving forward.
Correct. And I think some growth is better than no growth. And yes, it's a very competitive world and all of that. But you've also got to think about your long-term prosperity, right? If you have too much concentration risk in one person, what happens? It's key personnel risk. What happens to that one person? And in this situation, yes, Joe Biden has won, characters beat caricature, but this may not be set in stone, because all said and done, this cult of personality is still very powerful when it comes to leadership. We talk about it in Malaysia a lot, but around the world it is. That's why Trump got 70 million votes in the election. He could run in 2024 and win. You know, that's still up in the air. Because if in the next 4 years, let's say the Democrats get disillusioned by the Biden administration, say, you know what, I'd want to vote because it doesn't make a difference. That's the problem. We're expecting a lot out of 4 years.
We expect way too much.
Correct. Basically. So if everyone can just change their perspective of leadership and just see that hopefully Biden brings in younger people and stewards his cabinet towards and guides them towards doing their jobs respectively, and stop overemphasizing the role of the central or federal or prime minister or president or anything, any that one leader that will make or break the country one, or company.
Yeah, that one shining light, you know, that's supposed to guide your company or your country out of the darkness. That doesn't necessarily, it is a lot of concentration risk. And yesterday, you know, we were talking about figures like Elon Musk and Bill Gates and what kind of, you know, what kind of confluence of personality traits they have that make them the way they are. It's also not necessary that you need to have all of these things within one person. You can assemble a team that balances each other out, that has a diverse perspective, and you can still get a lot of good things done.
So very quickly there, Steve Jobs was a key personnel of Apple for a long time in the 2000s. He died, but the company kept on going because he built a very strong team around him. Tim Cook, Phil Schiller, Craig Federighi, these are all people in the top management that kept the company going. What happens after that? That's anyone's question, anyone's guess.
Succession planning is very important to keep in mind at all times. Anyway, do let us know what you think about this. Have we overemphasized the need for great leaders? WhatsApp us 01878988999 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up after Etta James with Something's Got a Hold on Me, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Are You In by Incubus, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark and Roshan Kanisan. Now, we are taking a trip round the world this morning, metaphorically speaking, of course, because we can't leave the country. Our first stop is in Singapore, where it looks like Singaporeans could be still living with virus curbs for more than a year to come. So this is even after it enters into the next stage of pandemic easing measures. So they are entering, I think, into what they call phase three, which their education minister has said is not a free-for-all. They will be in phase three for quite a while, at least until an effective vaccine or a treatment is widely available.
Yeah, so phase three is seeing some loosening of the SOPs, the precautions they've taken, and essentially trying to ease everyone into this new normal or next normal or whatever fancy word you want to use for this current situation that we're in. And this is kind of what Malaysia did a few months ago, and then we had a certain state election, and then everything seemed to go out the window after that.
A certain state election.
I'm not saying which state. I'm not saying when. I'm not saying who.
There's only one state election in recent history.
I don't know what you're talking about. But no, okay. but essentially it comes down to that, right? I mean, I honestly do wonder where we would be right now if, let's say, that state election didn't happen. Mm. Because we were doing quite well. I think all said and done, we were doing quite well in terms of the SOPs and the case numbers and things like that. And I think our community transmission was really, really low. Not to say it's high now, but we're seeing big numbers, right? And much concerning numbers at the very least. The question is going to be, going forward. I think what's important from this statement here from the his co-head of the virus task force in Singapore as well, the state city states virus task force, is that we have to figure out a way to live with the virus in the system for a while, because two things, right? We need to, one, wait for an effective vaccine, and two, vaccinations to happen. These are two things that could take some time, and we all have to get used to the fact that this could take some time, because even though we've seen, I think Moderna this earlier this week had a 94% efficacy rate, Pfizer's final data came out, they had a 95% efficacy rate. I think the Oxford AstraZeneca trials data has also come out, some of it, and it's positive. It doesn't look as promising as the other two. But again, all this is opening that light at the end of the tunnel, but that doesn't mean we're there just yet. So even so, when we relate it back to Malaysia, we need to figure out a way to work with this, right? Because we had an RMCO, which is kind of like phase three. And it's very important to remember that, like Lawrence Wong says, phase three is not a free for all. And if and when we get back to an RMCO, again, it's very important to remember it's not a free for all.
It's not. And until and unless we have a vaccine freely and readily available, our best security against contracting COVID-19 is to employ, you know, the SOPs, is to physical distance and wash your hands, wear a mask. That's just unfortunately going to be our reality for the foreseeable future, right? Because as encouraging as it is to see these vaccine candidates starting to crop up, and Pfizer they're saying that Pfizer may be the first now to file for US regulatory authorization, it's still going to be a long way before anything actually reaches us. And, you know, looking at this article talking about Singapore, they've had daily community cases at zero for 9 consecutive days so far. I mean, we came very close to that. It's still possible that we could get back to that if we are diligent about upholding our SOPs. So in the meantime, we are also looking at this other story this morning out of the APEC forum. That's happening over these couple of days. And President Xi Jinping of China said that China is going to be opening up its, and I quote, supersized economy to import more high quality goods and services. So China is also apparently going to be signing free trade pacts with more countries. But it is as yet unclear if US President Donald Trump will also be speaking at the event, which continues today.
Sorry, I just had to laugh at that. This was very good, right, in the sense that we're seeing that opening up of free trade starting to happen in this part of the world. So we had RCEP very recently signed. That's going to be important for the free flow of trade going forward. APEC, if we start seeing China utilizing its quote-unquote supersized economy to kind of increase the flow of trade. But in all this, I think it's very important to, again, relate to that conversation we had a little earlier, Lynn, about leadership and the cult of leadership and overemphasizing great leaders. We shouldn't be looking to China to be the new United States. We should, I think, overall be looking to have less concentration of global power in a country going forward, because I mean, the last 4 years, why are we so interested in the US? Because if the US sneezes, the rest of us catch a cold. The same happens with China. And the Chinese economy, the Chinese consumption, Chinese leadership becoming increasingly more powerful. Chinese debt and money is being used across the world in different economies to different degrees. These are all things we need to pay attention to. And in fact, I think, Lynn, you had a grill earlier this week with Murray Hebert, is that right?
Yes.
Who talked about this. He talked about how China is wielding its power in terms of its financial muscle to kind of curry favor with certain nations, or at least bring everyone into their economic fold.
Yeah, so he talked a little bit about this. So he came from very much from the perspective of Southeast Asia, because he's been a long-time observer in this region. He served as a journalist in Vietnam, in Myanmar, in Malaysia. So he was talking about, and he also made the point that ASEAN states really also do desperately need to come together, and even just to compare notes, because, you know, when it comes to balancing a large power, you know, the fact of the matter is that China has so much in its war chest that none of us could possibly compete alone. But we may have a chance standing together. That's the whole point of having an organization like ASEAN. Anyway, you can catch that conversation on the BFM app as well as on Spotify. But right now we're about to head into some messages, and then we're going to be looking at the front pages of our own papers and portals. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Go Away by Weezer and Beth Cosentino, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark and Roshan Kanesan. It is now 6:50 in the morning, Friday the 20th of November, and we have some local news for you this morning because we have our newspapers and some of our portals open today. I have the New Straits Times in front of me, and of course, their front page is quite eye-catching today because they have a very nice picture, I have to say, of a tiger on their front page, because their front story, their main story is about Zoo Negara. So this is accompanying a headline, "Help, Please," because Zoo Negara has fallen on hard times. So they've only apparently have sufficient funds left for about 3 months because, of course, there's not been much in the way of footfall and visitors coming to the zoo. I mean, even before the MCOs and the CMCOs happened, Zoo Negara was not exactly, perhaps we could, you know, you can say that it was not exactly the most popular place in terms of tourist attractions. So it's unfortunately, it's not got a very bright future ahead of them if they don't receive some kind of aid.
Yeah, that is not the best news to start the morning with. But, you know, on that note of Zoo Negara, Lynn, you'll be speaking with Aquawalk later at the Breakfast Grill. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Aquawalk Group is the parent company of Aquaria KLCC. They also run aquariums in Thailand, so Aquaria Phuket, as well as a few couple of stakes in aquariums in Jakarta. And these are some of the largest aquariums in Southeast Asia. And they are also, of course, suffering because of a lack of footfall traffic. And it's not just initially, I mean, they apparently usually get about 900,000 visitors a year. And that has dropped off significantly because they've only been able to operate maybe 7 months out of this year. And actually, I think last week they announced, unfortunately, that they would have to close for the remainder of the CMCO whenever that's going to end. So it's also not looking that good for them. So we're going to be speaking with its executive director, Daryl Fong, later on the Breakfast Grill. So be sure to catch that. What else do you have in the Malaysian Reserve and the Star?
Roshan? So let's go with the Star first, because there are three stories here on the front page, and we're going to go through each and every one of them. So the first one
Brace yourselves.
At the very top is injecting millions for a vaccine. And this is on page 3, if you follow through with the story. But essentially, it's Malaysia will make an initial payment of 94 million ringgit for participation in the COVAX facility, which is the first step towards accessing the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, if you're not sure what that is, COVAX is a global initiative supported by the WHO to ensure fair and equitable access to COVID-19 vaccine worldwide. Now, Khairi Jamaluddin, the Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, was answering Lim Guan Eng's question in Parliament yesterday. And so this 100 million ringgit, or almost 100 million ringgit that we spent, will be followed up later on, because Malaysia is expected to eventually pay 3 billion ringgit for a vaccine to cover 10% of the population under the COVAX facility. So this is that's the first story on the front page. Then we have the other story, which is about wristbands in foreign workers. The National Security Council is expected to discuss today a proposal to make it compulsory for foreign workers in certain sectors to wear identification wristbands, a measure that could help with early detection and isolation of COVID-19 cases. But immediately, I think when you're hearing me, there's a little bit of a jarring tone to that, because, and some industry players do feel that, because they feel it could stigmatize foreign workers by basically identifying them through the use of tags. So we'll be watching how that plays out. And the last one here, which is a bit more optimistic, I feel, it's a bit of a celebration, because there's a photo here, and scaling new heights with a record feat. And this is tower runner So Wai Ching, who successfully broke the Guinness World Record for the greatest vertical height stair climbing in 1 hour. And this happened at the Four Seasons Hotel in Kuala Lumpur, which is 66 floors. So he runs up, then he goes back down the elevator, and he runs back up, and he ran a distance of 1,295.95 meters, breaking the 1,227 meter record set by Spaniard David Robles in Spain last year. So a little bit of a celebratory tone there. And yes, That's 1.2 kilometers he ran up the stairs.
That's 132 flights of floors that he ran up, because he did the 66 floors twice. And honestly, my heart is racing just thinking about it.
Or I'm not sure how many times he did it, but basically you run up the staircase and then you go down the elevator and then you run up the staircase again. Now, the title
is... Not my idea of fun, guys.
Yeah, he hasn't officially gotten the Guinness record just yet, because Guinness is going to take two days to verify the results. They're going to have to go through all the video footage that they took to verify every single part of it. Sounds like an exciting job.
Interesting times indeed. And of course, just very quickly, the CEO morning brief, their front page this morning is: government hopes that IRB can achieve its tax collection target of 127 billion ringgit this year. So that is a little bit of optimism on the part of the Ministry of Finance, because of course, you know, the country's not in a great place at the moment. But in order to spur our economy, the government has to spend, and that money has to come from somewhere. But right now, we are about to head into our 7 o'clock news bulletin, and then more business news and analysis for you. But first, some music. Here is Cold as Ice by Foreigner, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.